make a comment on what's going on outside. If I didn't have to be here to teach you, which I consider much more important than any Hafganah, the biggest Hafganah is to learn Torah, and that will help to take away a lot of the evils of the world. Insofar that there is a protest going on that a secular Israeli court, even the high court, has no right to tell people where to send their children to be educated. That is not the decision of a secular court. It's a decision of Rabbonim, it's a decision of parents. In that I join in that protest. However, since it is a very hazy issue as what exactly the complaints of the parents in Emmanuel are, and in the secular community, and even to a certain degree in the religious community, there is a feeling that this is Sfardim against Ashkenazim and has nothing to do with principles of education and religion or whatever. It's just that people don't want their children to be together with Sfardim. That I also protest. That is totally inane. And that there should be separations, not anything to do with Yiddishkeit, people on the same level of Torah observance or whatever, just that they happen to be Sfardim or Ashkenazim and they can't go to the same school, that bothers me a lot too. However, even in that, I'm here long enough to understand that there are different mentalities amongst people and different ways of life, even amongst Jews, different minhagim. And therefore, sometimes what is best is that each community have its own education according to its own mentality and its own customs or whatever. But to make it so intense that somebody doesn't want his children to have anything to do with children from a different background, and again, it has nothing to do, if it has nothing to do with religiosity or hashkafa, right? That in itself is a very negative thing that needs to be protested also. And here, like everything, it's very unclear what exactly the points are. And since the Gedolim said that people should go out and protest, I probably would be there, even though I shy away from all protests. So it's a good excuse to be here. What I protest, I said, and what I am not protesting, what I am protesting against also, I also said. So I go on record having fulfilled my responsibility. Okay. Let's start with something from the end of the Sedra, which shouldn't take us too long, and then something from the beginning of the Sedra, and then if there's time, something from towards the beginning of the Sedra. Torah says like this. Let me give you the background of the simple meaning and then the drasha that Chazal say. Torah says that Sichon, who was the king, what's it called? Sichon Melech Emori was an Emorite king who the Jewish people had a mitzvah once he said that he's not interested in making peace, a mitzvah of totally conquering him and destroying him. He had previously conquered a city called Cheshbon. Cheshbon was a city that belonged to Moab. Moab, we are not allowed to start a war with Moab, nor are we allowed to conquer land from them and take land away from them. Moab came from Lot, and the Rabbanu Shalom protected the rights of Lot's children, Ammon and Moab, to their land. And we're not even allowed to start up with them. surely not to make a war, and surely not allowed to take their, what's it called, their property. However, even a war, in a war, we weren't allowed to make a war, and if we made a war, we weren't allowed to keep their property. However, once the land was conquered by Sihon, so the Gemara says, Tiharu, there were certain lands that were cleansed, laundered, mamish, laundry, were laundered. They originally would have been prohibited for us to take, but since they were conquered by Sihon, and he became the owner of them, now we could conquer them and take them from Sihon. We weren't taking it from Moab, it already was taken by Sihon from Moab. So these lands were nitar, were laundered by Sihon, and then we were able to conquer them. So when we conquered Sihon, we got Cheshbon. So in the describing this, and Sihon made Cheshbon his capital city. So it says, Al Kain Yomru Hamoshlim, therefore the rulers used to say, Bo Cheshbon, come to the city of Cheshbon, Tibone v'sikonein ir Sihon, build it up. It was captured from Moab, it was converted into a capital city of Sihon, the symbol of his empire. Come to Sihon, come to Cheshbon, Tibone v'sikonein ir Sihon, build up and establish a city of Sihon. And then it goes on, Ki yesh yotza, a fire went out from Cheshbon, and it consumed everything around. Okay, that's the simple meaning of the pasuk. The rabbis darshan this pasuk with a drasha. Al kein bo Cheshbon. Come and make the tally, the reckoning of the world. Cheshbon no shalola. Schar mitzvah, what is the reckoning of the world? The word Cheshbon means a reckoning, right? Adding up a sum. Reckoning a sum. So, bo Cheshbon, come and make the reckoning of the world. Schar mitzvah keneged hefseda, tally, reckon the reward of a mitzvah opposite its loss. Uschar avera, and the benefit of a sin, keneged hefseda, opposite its loss. And seemingly, if you make that reckoning, you'll do mitzvahs and you won't do averas. And then the people who know how to make that reckoning, who have already come to the conclusion of how to live in this world properly, so they were able to give mussar to the people who haven't made this reckoning yet. And the Mesillas Yesharim brings this down as this is an ideal way for people to know how to live in this world by following people who have already conquered the Yetzer Hara and have made this reckoning properly. And he gives the example of somebody who is in a maze and doesn't know how to get out of it. The way to get out of it is to follow the people who already been through it and got to the end. Okay, in any case, this, I just want to speak about the first part of it. Bo Cheshbon, come and make the reckoning of the world. The reward for a mitzvah opposite its loss. And the reward, schar avera, opposite its loss. Now, normally, these words don't go together. Normally, you have schar mitzvah and onish. Schar and onish. You have the reward for a mitzvah, and then you have the loss if you don't do the mitzvah. That I understand. But for the avera, it should say the onish, make the reckoning of the punishment of the avera, opposite the loss that you won't have, that you'll have if you don't do the avera, whatever, or the benefit you'll have. It should have said schar mitzvah keneged hefseda, the reward of a mitzvah opposite the loss, or even better, it should have said the reward of the mitzvah opposite the punishment you'll get if you don't do the mitzvah. And it should have said the punishment you get for doing the avera opposite the reward you'll get for not doing it. It should have compared reward and punishment, not reward and loss. Loss usually goes opposite benefit, gain. The gain and the loss. So it should have said the gain you'll have from the mitzvah opposite the loss, or the loss you'll have from the avera opposite the gain, or the reward you'll have for the mitzvah opposite the punishment, or the punishment you'll have for the avera opposite the reward. Why does it mix these two concepts together, reward and loss, and what kind of reward is there for a mitzvah, for an aveira? Should have said the punishment of the aveira opposite the loss you'll have if you don't do the aveira, whatever it may be. So on a simple level, I want to say like this. What the Gemara is telling you is the following fact. Why don't you say, look, always do mitzvahs because they're always beneficial, and don't do aveiras because they're always detrimental. Why do you have to make any kind of tally? Why do you have to reckon the mitzvah, the reward opposite the loss? I think what he's coming to tell me is the following. If you don't deal in this world realistically, then you can be starry-eyed and see mitzvahs, wow, mitzvahs are just positive, right? Mitzvahs are the thing to do. There's no loss in doing a mitzvah. There's just reward, and why shouldn't I do a mitzvah? And then sometimes reality hits you when you open your eyes, right, and you see that mitzvahs cost money. And because it costs money, you may not have the money to do things that are even basics if you spend it on the mitzvah. And sometimes you're required to spend it on the mitzvah. So the mitzvah is a little oppressive. There's a loss in that mitzvah. Sometimes the mitzvah costs time, and you need the time for something else. But you have to give up the time. It involves a sacrifice. Sometimes the mitzvah will cause you problems. By doing this mitzvah, right, you're going to have problem X, Y, Z with family, with friends, with business, with your parnasa. Mitzvahs many times involve losses. But you should always realize that if you'll make the tally of the benefit that you'll get from the mitzvah, and the reward for the mitzvah always outweighs the problems and the losses the mitzvah can generate. But if you don't realize that mitzvahs can generate problems, then the first little problem you have, you're not going to do the mitzvah. If you only do mitzvahs because they are really only positive, then when the reality hits you that they're not positive in this situation, you may not do it. In addition, if you take into consideration the fact that the mitzvah has a downside, everything in this world, since the sin of Adam and Chava, has an upside and a downside. Nothing is perfect, perfectly good, or perfectly bad. Every bad has some good in it, and every good has some bad in it. And if you don't understand that, and don't realize it, and don't take it into consideration, then firstly, your whole approach to mitzvahs may lead you not to do mitzvahs. Because you're going to be under the impression that mitzvahs are only positive things. And then when you're up against some negative results of mitzvahs, you're just going to forget about it. But if you take that in consideration to begin with, right, and you still make the tally, and you realize that even though there are downsides to mitzvahs, it's still worth doing the mitzvah, then you'll do it anyway. There's another benefit in making this tally, and that is to try to minimize the downside. If you take into consideration the negatives that the mitzvah may generate, right, then you'll be able to deal with it and try to minimize them. Try to minimize the detriments, the losses that you'll have by doing the mitzvah. If you don't take them into consideration, there's no way that you can deal with them. And you won't be able to minimize them. A third benefit. What?
The losses of not doing.
You still do the mitzvah. Right. The losses of doing the mitzvah. Right. Even if you do the mitzvah, you're going to lose time, money, you're going to break up family relations, you're going to lose friends, right? You're going to take time off your business. There are a lot of things that could be generated as a result of doing a mitzvah that are negative. So if you don't understand that that is the way the world is, then you may, when you come to realize that there are negatives, you may not do the mitzvah altogether. So therefore, it's important to know the pluses and the minuses, and still to know that it's worth doing the mitzvah. It's the first benefit of making this tally. Secondly, if you take into consideration the losses from the mitzvah, you'll be able to minimize them. To take them in consideration, try to do the mitzvah in such a way that it will minimize the loss. Okay? You'll try to do it in a time when it won't conflict with your parnasa. You'll try to do it in a way that won't offend your relatives. And so on. The third benefit is what the Shurei Das says. He says that tzaddikim promise a little, say a little, and do a lot. Whereas Rishoyim promise you the world and they don't do too much. He says it's not because Rishoyim are liars and they lie and they promise you a lot and they never intended to do it. They want to do a lot. And they promise you a lot. But they don't realize that there are pitfalls that they can't necessarily control unless they... So the little smallest little pitfall right away puts them out of commission. If you don't anticipate problems, you'll never be able to deal with it. On the other hand, tzaddikim know that they have a yetzer hara, and there are problems in this world, and you have to face them. So since they consider them, and they know that they can't promise a lot because there are pitfalls along the way, since they anticipate the pitfalls, they're able to overcome them. So that's why the yetzer hara in the future, God is going to destroy the yetzer hara in front of the tzaddikim and rishoyim. The tzaddikim are going to look like to the yetzer hara like a big mountain, and the Rishoyim like a little hair's breadth. He says because the Rishoyim never got over that hair's breadth. The first little thing tripped them up because they didn't anticipate any problems. But the Tzaddikim anticipated the problems and met them head on and overcame them. So by them the Yetzer Hara accumulated to a big mountain, but they were able to accomplish by conquering that mountain. But the Rishoyim never got past the first hair breadth. To them, the Yetzer Hara was a hair breadth, which they couldn't do because they couldn't anticipate it, so they never were able to overcome it. If you don't anticipate the fact that mitzvahs have a downside, that there are losses that you could incur by doing a mitzvah, then you'll never anticipate how to counteract those losses, and they'll vanquish you and you'll be finished. But if you understand that there are problems with doing mitzvahs sometimes, many times, and you anticipate them, then you will be able to overcome those problems and do the mitzvah. So for those three reasons, a person should not just be euphoric, mitzvahs, wow, that's great, we always do mitzvahs because mitzvahs are great, there's no detriment from a mitzvah. That's very euphoric, but it's not real. And because it's not real, right, you're going to fall flat on your face if you have that approach and hit reality. So it's better to be realistic, to anticipate the downside of a mitzvah, and in that way, you will do the mitzvah even though you know that there'll be any losses, because you're ready to face that reality. You will minimize the downside, and you'll be able to overcome the downside because you anticipated it. Same thing goes with the Aveira. Every Aveira has benefits. There are benefits from doing an Aveira, right? Concrete things, but it's always better not to do the Aveira. But if you have this philosophy that Aveiras are bad, they're terrible, there's no benefit to them, and then you find out there is a benefit, you may end up doing the Aveira. Because you have this idea, this approach that Aveiras are terrible. But if you see that Aveiras could give you a benefit, then you weren't prepared for that. So the first thing is, understand that Aveiras also have an upside. And still, it's better not to do the Aveira. It's not worth it. Secondly, if you know that the Aveira will give you a benefit, and you're not going to do it, maybe you can find a way of getting that benefit without doing the Aveira. And thirdly, if you understand that the Aveira can give you a benefit, right, then you anticipate it, you will not do the Aveira and somehow get that benefit some other way. Similar to the second idea, but it's the same idea. So therefore, always tally, always reckon the reward of a mitzvah opposite its loss. Take in consideration the loss. And the reward that you'll get for not doing an Aveira opposite the loss you'll have by not doing that Aveira, take it in consideration, and it will make not doing the Aveira much more effective than doing it in an unrealistic, starry-eyed way. Okay, that's one idea. The second idea I was thinking of is the following. A person, cheshbono shel olam, person can do mitzvahs and aveiras in a very individual, private way. I was going to say selfish, but it's not really selfish. Right? In other words, if I do this mitzvah, I'll get rewarded. I'll get a more olam haba. Okay? If I don't do the mitzvah, I won't get the reward. That's one way of looking at doing mitzvahs and not doing mitzvahs. Aveira, the same thing. If I do this Aveira, I'll get punished. If I don't do the Aveira, I'll be rewarded for not doing it. Okay. But there's cheshbono shel olam. there's a much more universal, grander way at looking at the incentive to do mitzvahs and not do aveiros. Not just your own personal reward for doing the mitzvah or not doing the aveiro. But take in consideration not just the reward of the mitzvah, but the loss the world would have if you didn't do this mitzvah. Not just the reward you would be missing. What would the world be missing if it didn't have this mitzvah? How does your mitzvah affect the world? Bo cheshbon, right? Come and see the, what's it called, the cheshbono shel olam, the reckoning of the world, not just your own personal cheshbon, but the cheshbon of the whole world, right? So consider the reward you'll get for a mitzvah, but don't consider that alone. Consider it opposite the loss the world would have that if you didn't do this mitzvah, not just the reward you would be missing. But what's the world going to be benefiting? Same thing with the Aveira. Don't only look at the reward you'll get for not doing the Aveira. Schar Aveira means the reward you'll get for not doing the Aveira. But what would the world lose if you did that Aveira? How's the world going to be affected by your doing that Aveira? By not doing the Aveira? So what should motivate you is not only your own personal, selfish cheshbonos, but bo v'nasa cheshbono shel olam, look at it in a much more universal, eternal way, as when you do mitzvahs or don't do averas, how it affects the world around you. And Chazal say that when a person does a mitzvah or does an avera, he should consider himself half and half, and the world half and half, and one mitzvah can tip the scales for the whole world to the positive side, and one avera can tip the scales of the whole world to the negative side. Don't only consider your own personal position, look at how the world's going to be affected. Yeah.
I understand the notion of having that awareness, but because it's a cheshbon that we have no idea how it works, is it really a fact that we should?
Yeah, it doesn't mean you have to know the points, but it means you should know the concept. That's the cheshbon. The cheshbon is taking that concept into consideration, where what you do becomes not just important because of your own personal future plight and present plight, but the plight of the whole world. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is a loaded or stumped question, but when we look at a Gemara like you just quoted, like the Rav quoted there, about see as if the world is totally on you, essentially. That if you do this, then it'll push them this way. If you do it this way, then it'll push them the other way. Is it potentially that Gemara is a motivational Gemara, if you will? Or
yeah.
Is it potentially... No, that's the emes. That's the reality. That's how it is. And so therefore
the reality is that it could be like that. It's not every situation. When you do a mitzvah, the world is half and half. But it definitely could be like that. And since it's possible to be like that, that gives a person an extra motivation to consider that, even if it's not like that, but look what one mitzvah can do. That means that one mitzvah is very significant. And even if it's not half and half, but it doesn't take away the significance of the mitzvah. Because in a case where it would be half and half, that mitzvah would make the difference for me and the entire world. Then just because it's not half and half doesn't mean the mitzvah has less significance. So you can learn from the most extreme case how significant the mitzvah is even in every regular case. So it's a combination of both. Okay, let's go on to a different inyan. The beginning of the Sedra, Parah Aduma. Parah Aduma is at the same time a means of purifying somebody who became tamei by contact with the dead in some way, and it also is a kapara for the cheto egel. Now the connection between those things is that had it not been for the cheto egel, when we received the Torah, death would have been abolished. That doesn't mean people would have lived forever. What it means is that people would have accomplished in this world what they needed to do, and they would have graduated to Olam Haba, like the Ramchal says, by the time of Adam and Chava. The concept of death wouldn't have existed, right? Their bodies and souls would have symbiotically perfected each other until the soul would have turned the body into a quasi-spiritual being that could go into the next world. Just like Eliyahu HaNavi went into the next world alive or whatever, you would have graduated to the next world, not having to die. Death is a separation between the physical and spiritual sides. Now, that is sin. Sin is where you do something that your physical side is involved in, but your spiritual side has no connection to that. It's detrimental to your spiritual side. So all sin is like a minor death, separation between the physical and the spiritual. And that's what tumah is. Tumah is what's affected when the physical and the spiritual separate, and there is a certain idea of death. That's why the main tumah is death. But tumahs of a seminal emission is a kind of death. The sperm had the ability to bring life, and now it went to waste. It can't bring life. A woman menstruating, right? She was ready to bring new life. She could have become pregnant, and now the breakdown of the tissue in the womb, she can't get pregnant during that time. So it's also like a little bit of a death. Shrutzim are what's it called? Animals that if you eat them, they're metamtim esalev. They separate between your spiritual side and physical side. They're like spiritual cholesterol. They clog up your heart arteries spiritually. So you're separated from godliness, from attaching yourself intellectually with God. It's also a kind of death. So at the same time that death became necessary was the same result of the Chet HaEgel. What was the Chet HaEgel? Where people separated between God and the physical world with this golden calf that supposedly now is going to be an intermediary between God and them, separation between God and the world. So that's the idea of sin, and the idea of tumah go together. Had there not been sin, there wouldn't be death. Had there not been death, there wouldn't be tumah. There wouldn't be that separation between the spiritual and the physical. So therefore, when a person sins, so he has to do tshuva. He has to return. He's separated now from God. He has to return to God. Get closer again. Break that separation. So the Parah Adumah represents, I think, conceptually, and again, there's a million different ideas. I'm just giving you one interesting idea I thought of. How the Parah Adumah makes you once again be able to get back close to God, to break that separation. First thing is, you have to take the parah. It comes to atone for the sin of the golden calf, which is a symbol of all sin, where you separate yourself from God, and you look at the physical world separated from the spiritual world. Okay, that's the idea of the golden calf. And that's all sin is like that. I'm indulging in something physical that's totally separated from the spiritual. I'm not using the physical world to enhance and promote the spiritual. I'm using it in conflict with the spiritual. So the first thing is, call the mother of the calf and let her clean up for the child. Meaning, don't only look at the sin itself. You sinned. You did something. You stole something. It's a sin. Go back and look at the causes of that sin. Don't attack the sin itself. Look for what caused it. What bad character traits did you have? What led you to the actual action of stealing? Right? Bad midos, bad hashkafos. There are roots to sins. So first trace the roots. Don't attack the calf. Go back to the mother. Try to find the roots for that sin. That's one idea. Second idea is that the mother, it says that if a kid goes to a party, eats and drinks too much, and throws up. Who do you call to clean up the vomit? The mother. Why? Because the mother is not repulsed by even the most disgusting things that their child does. Right? A mother changes a baby's diapers out of love. It's like an extension of them. Therefore, if you want to return to God, don't think he's repulsed by the sin that you did. He's like the mother. He's what's it called? The Ribbono Shel Olam loves us so much that even Hashochein Itam B'Sof Tumasav, even in the midst of our impurity, God's there with us. He's like the mother. He's not repulsed by anything. He wants us to do right. The mother is upset that the child misbehaved and vomited, but she's willing to clean it up. She's not repulsed by it because of her love for her child. So when you approach doing tshuva, realize that even though you did terrible things, you're not necessarily a terrible person, and the Ribbono Shel Olam isn't repulsed by you, even though he's upset with you, because he'll help to cleanse it, because he's like the mother coming to cleanse the child. Now, the Parah Adumah has to be totally red. Red is a symbol of sin. People many times justify the sins that they have. Yeah, I sin, but... In fact, I like to say in a cute way, The Rambam says that the main vidui, the main confession of Yom Kippur is Avol Anachnu Chatanu, which translated loosely is, but we have sinned. The real translation is, verily we have sinned. Avol can mean verily, in truth. But it has the connotation, Avol means but. So how does it fit, but we have sinned? So I was thinking that maybe you can explain it the following way. The whole year we say those same three words in a different order. We have sinned, but. And we have this excuse and that excuse and this, what's it called, justification. That, by the time you're finished, there's no more sin. If anything, it's a mitzvah. That's not confession. On Yom Kippur, you have to come and change the order. Avol, after all the ifs, ands, and buts, anachnu chatanu, we still sin. That's the confession of Yom Kippur. After all the ifs, ands, and buts, it's still anachnu chatanu. Don't put the excuses after the confession, put them all before and come to the conclusion it's still a sin. So therefore, the next thing is, go and trace the sin back to its source. Realize that just like the mother will cleanse the child, the Rabban Shalom wants to cleanse you. He's not repulsed by you. He'll come and clean up the most disgusting thing because it's child. So that will give you the incentive to want to do tshuva and to get closer to the Rabban Shalom, to know that he's concerned. He wants to cleanse you from your sins. And then accept the sin for what it is. Totally red. Don't have some black spotches on the para. It's red. There's no justifications. There's no excuses. See it the way it is. It's a sin. Then, shelo alayal le'ol. The para aduma can have never had a yoke on it. Understand that basically the problem with sin is not so much the individual thing you did, but it is a sign that you don't have the yoke of heaven on your shoulders. If you could do something against God's will, then obviously you don't have the yoke of heaven. So it's not just you did this sin. Don't hone in on the individual sin itself. Understand that it's a sign that you've thrown off the yoke of heaven from yourself. That's what that sin represents. Didn't have a yoke on it. And it has to be, what's it called? Mashaloh le'ol. And then you have to add a few other ingredients. One ingredient is an eitz eres that you burn together with this part, which is a part of a cedar tree, big, high tree. That represents the fact that people sin many times because they're too haughty. They're not humble enough. And they think that they can do whatever they want, and they don't realize that they have to subjugate and subdue themselves before God. And haughtiness is a cause of sin. So throw in the cedar tree. But there's another cause of sin on the other end, and that is no self-esteem. Person doesn't feel he's worth anything. He has no self-worth. So then what difference does it make what I do? If I'm good for nothing, then I do good for nothing things. But if I would have self-esteem and understand that I'm important, and especially in God's eyes, then I have responsibility in this world. So either you can sin because you're too haughty, or because you have no self-esteem. Now, what's the difference between haughtiness and self-esteem? In two sentences. Haughtiness is, I'm important because I made myself important, and that gives me rights. That's haughtiness. That's awesome. That's no good. What's self-esteem? I'm important because God made me important, and that gives me responsibility. That's self-esteem. So sometimes people sin because they have no self-esteem, because they're too lowly. That's why we take the azov. The azov is a hyssop, is a worthless weed. If you consider yourself a worthless weed, throw that also into the whole thing. Burn that too. It's not a good feeling. If you consider yourself a cedar tree, also not good. Don't be too haughty. Don't have no self-esteem. And then, the last ingredient is a shnitolas, is a piece of wool dyed red. Okay, which has the following idea. Shnitolas is part of the problem of the Yetzer Hara is dying. It says the what's it called? Shochet. The Baal Shem Tov says this in a euphemistic way. The Gemara says when you slaughter an animal on Shabbos, what malacha are you doing? So Rav said it's netilas neshama. Or Rav Shmuel says netilas neshama. you're taking away the life of the animal. That's the malacha. The malacha is taking away life. And Rav said it's soveya. It's dying, D-Y-E-I-N-G, the throat of the animal with the blood, make it look fresh. So it's dying. It's the malacha of soveya, coloring. So the Baal Shem Tov learned this Gemara euphemistically. The shochet is the malach hamavis, the yetzer hara. Why is he going to be held responsible in the future for coming and making people sin and what's it called and having them killed, and in the end he did his job. So in the end God is going to shecht the yetzer hara. Why is he going to be liable? He did his job. So the Gemara says for two reasons. One is netilas neshama. He did his job too good. He shouldn't have been so successful to make people die because of the sins that they did. He was too successful. And the second opinion is because he dies the aveirah. If the Yetzer Hara would come and say, "Don't get up for davening. Go to sleep. Sleep is sweet. Sleep. Don't get up. Miss davening." Okay, then you have an even chance. You could listen to him, or you could go to davening. But the Yetzer Hara doesn't come like that. He colors the aveirah, makes it look like a mitzvah. He comes and says, "You could get up, go to davening, but then you'll be tired the whole day. You won't learn a word first Seder. You'll be dead tired second Seder. A whole day of learning is going to be, is it davening worth that? Dead or sleep an extra hour, and you'll be well rested, and you'll become the first Seder, and you'll be able to learn so much better. So you missed one davening, but it's worth it." So he turns the missing the davening into a mitzvah. He's coloring the aveira, dyeing it, misrepresenting it. That's why he's going to be chayiv. It's the same thing over here. Take a piece of dyed wool and realize that sometimes the sins, what's it called, appear to be mitzvahs when they're really sins. And sometimes mitzvahs appear to be sin when they're really mitzvah. So be afraid of the dyeing process over here that may totally misrepresent what's going on. So throw all those things into the fire, reduce them to ashes, and start again. And then combine the ashes with living water, spring water, which is a symbol of what? Torah. Now that you've atoned for the sin, now start doing good things. Not good enough just not to do bad things. Now take those ashes, combine them with Torah, and now you'll be able to start anew. And it's not just your own personal quest, but help somebody else out in making that transformation. Therefore, a person can't sprinkle the parah aduma on himself. He has to have somebody else sprinkle it. Jews are responsible one for the other. Every person should help every other person do this process and do tshuva. If you have the ability to help somebody else, help somebody else. If they have the ability to help you, they'll help you. Can't do it yourself. You need all Klal Yisrael. And even if you're going to become a little bit tameh, helping somebody else, it's worth it. Make them tar. So that's the process of tshuva. The process of tshuva is bring the mother, search out the causes, the roots of the sin. Don't only look at the sin itself in a very narrow way, so you'll know what brought you to the sin, what you're going to have to correct. Right? Just don't say, "I'm not going to steal again." But maybe you're too jealous, or you're too selfish, or you're too materialistic, and that's what brought you to steal. So you have to work on those things, and that will help that you shouldn't steal again. Maybe you don't respect other people's property. That's why you stole. So find, first of all, what brought you to the sin, and work on that, not only on the sin itself. Bring the mother. Realize that God is like the mother. He's not repulsed from anything you did, and he's upset with you. He wants you to repent, but he's willing to help you through the process, because like the mother is willing to clean up anything the child did, because part of her. Third thing, recognize the fact, don't make justifications and excuses. Look at the sin as totally red. No black hairs. And then, what's it called? Take away the haughtiness. Take away the, what's it called? The low self-esteem. Take away the coloring of the sin, distorting it. And realize that all sin is a result of not having a yoke on your neck, the yoke of heaven. And burn it all, start again, combine it with Torah. It's not good enough just to go away from the bad, but now you have to know how to use your new situation for good, combine it with the living waters of Torah, and have a relationship with other Jews who will help you through the process. Jews have to help each other. You can't do it on your own. You need to do it as part of the tzibur, as part of the club. I think that's one of the hints, perhaps, of the whole process of the Paradum.